the hard yards, passionate about sport.
It's gone to the short side. Oh, it's not gone to the short side. It's gone to the try line.
I don't think we met before, but I'm the referee on this field, not you.
Hi Rob, Zeeb's here. Just want to discuss the captaincy next.
He's calling.
When Ringrose comes through. Oh. That is brilliant from Ringrose. Ringrose is going here. What a score.
You're very welcome to the Hard Yards. I'm Andy McGeady. We have another great show lined up for you today. I'm joined in studio by former Leinster and Ireland back row Kevin McLaughlin and Sports Joe reporter Pat McCarry. Gents, hello.
Good morning.
Hey, how are you?
We're also joined on the line by Munster forwards coach Gerry Flannery. Fla, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Andy.
And later on, we'll be talking with Alan Dimmock from Rugby World magazine about an investigation into player migration in rugby. That's a good one. I'll recommend you stay around for that. But first, gents, Kev, you're looking well.
Thank you very much.
Been a little while.
Yeah, it has been. Busy with work.
Yeah.
Bosses have me travelling around Europe, so I haven't been able to drop in the last few weeks, but delighted to be back.
It's okay, earn your coin. Pat, you're busy this week.
Yeah, away from work, the hobby. I had my opening night in our Christmas show last night as Santa Claus. So
you better work on a beard.
Yeah, I know. I look like a hobo at the moment.
Can we have a ho ho ho?
Wait, I have to get a bit of a laugh going on first. Like,
it's actually not terrible.
Yes,
it's fucking terrifying. That's what it is.
And we charge people for that.
Excellent.
Just me doing that for 2 hours.
Sold out show. Good man. Gerry, I'm going to assume you're looking well too.
Okay,
fair enough. Gerry, this is your third time in the Hard Yards, but it's not actually really your third time in the Hard Yards, because there was another show called The Hard Yards that yourself and Mal O'Kelly used to do. And in the very first episode, you left the studio, apparently, jumped over a wall and attacked a man blowing leaves in the car park. Is this true?
No, that's an add-on. There was a guy with a leaf blower. I didn't attack him. I just went out and asked him to stop doing it. But I thought we were the original Hard Yards when we started. But he seemed to have pretended that he started your own show. Now we've got the same name.
I think it's like the Michael Keaton Batman, and you guys were the George Clooney Batman, I think.
Yeah. Cheers. Thanks for that one.
Clooney's a good looking man, though.
Which of us are Clooney?
Clooney's the one that it's contractually he's never allowed to talk about again. That was the one with Schwarzenegger. Okay. Mr. Freeze or something like that.
I'll have to watch back. Christmas will give me this time to catch up on my Batman knowledge. So listen, Kev and Gerry, you've been looking at times that these lads played against each other or with each other. What did you find?
Yeah, it was. I was seeing the last Leinster Munster game that Gerry played was. It was a game where you got man of the match, Kev, and you said it was the best rugby performance you've ever been involved in. It's a 30-0 win, and you got man of the match as well.
In the RDS, it was just towards the start of my career. I think it was like probably only about my seventh or eighth start for Leinster, and obviously Gerry was very, very senior person at that point in the Munster squad. Obviously I remember that game, getting man of the match and stuff was special, but yeah, like me and Gerry, I think maybe only played together once or twice
for
Ireland. I remember like the Gerry, like, because at the time I was there was a couple of articles came out saying I was in a choir and different college stuff, and like most lads were just kind of actively taking the piss out of me, but Fla, like on the coach, you might remember Fla, you'd be kind of quizzing me about it, and like I was really as you were talking trying to figure out whether you were taking the piss or being serious, and I just couldn't decide what it was, but it seemed genuine at the time, and like asking me to sing a song and different things like that. But what I really appreciated Fla was he was the one person I knew in the Irish squad who could get under Reds or skin whenever he wanted. So I own Redden.
Yeah.
Like Reds are when it comes to banter, he's good at getting under other people's skin, and there were very few people who could get under his, but Fla was an absolute specialist in it, so I always really appreciated that skill of his.
Yeah, I'm glad I brought something to the squad when I was in there.
Yeah, you were actually the game that you, it was your debut that you played. It was against Italy, and Jerry was starting hooker in that game. It was the game in Croke Park. That was that was your first time you guys played together.
Yeah, it was, and it wasn't, I don't think, a particularly exciting game, but I think Leo was playing that game as well.
That usually helps make it a bit messy, yeah.
Yeah,
in a good way.
Yeah, Italy, Leo playing is always going to be a bit messy, but we got a win anyway, I suppose. That was the important thing.
Yeah, so Fla, and those times in the bus, what was the truth? Were you just trying to wind up the new lad, or were you really interested in his singing?
No, I was just trying to get a feel for guys when they come into the squad, and Kev was probably quiet enough when he came in, so you're trying to tease it out of him and get him to come out of his shell a bit. I thought he was a good line-out. He was a good line-out option, so I liked him straight away because it made my job a bit easier. And I was just trying to, you know, you want to try and get a bit of a connection with a guy, so he'd give you feedback. The more you chat to a guy, whether you do it from slagging him a bit, like to try and break down a few barriers, because I think that's like what Kev was alluding to. What Reds are like, Reds are played with Munster, with Connacht, and with Leinster. So he kind of was a good guy that kind of brought people together, and everyone would be kind of trying to get at Redzer then, and it kind of gave us all a kind of a unified focus of just trying to slag off Owen. But those small things kind of, yeah, well, like they kind of give you something to chat over and stuff like that, and give you a common ground, and then it helps develop your relationship then, so that when you're on the field, people aren't afraid to tell you what they want, and they're, you know, you can't afford to be, I kind of, you know, hurt this guy's feelings or anything like that. So yeah, I remember Kev's first game. I remember his second game even better, because that was over in France, we were in Paris, and it was a week off after it, so we generally hit the first caps then, which we did back then. I don't know, was that 2010 or when was it, but I think one of the French hooker, I think it was William Servat, came over with a bottle of Pernod, and we started pouring loads of Pernod into Kev, and it didn't end well for him.
Yeah, funny.
It certainly did not.
I was never lucky enough or talented enough to play rugby at any level, but I was the victim of a Pernod incident on a rugby trip to Toulouse once. So I sympathise with your plight.
I've never been an abusive drunk until that night. And it's nice to pick your time to be an abusive drunk when all the kind of top RFU officials are around.
It's really
ideal for your career.
Good moment.
Nah, I mean, I got away. I had to make a couple of apologies the next day, but like, I had genuinely no control over what I was doing. I had to drink what I was given. And like Flav said, all was going okay. It was red wine and beer until William Servat came over. And then it was all downhill from then.
Downhill with a brick in the accelerator.
Yeah, exactly. And nowhere to go except down. Yeah. So
I'm interested to... So you arrive in the squad. Flav's going deadly. I've got another line-out man. But then you added something else during your career, which was the ability to play multiple positions. So you could play six, you could play lock. Did you like playing lock, or were you covering lock?
I was always covering lock.
Yeah.
Do you know what was really interesting? I think it's the same for anyone who can play in different positions. Is I was always very comfortable in six, but when I moved into second row, there were always a couple of things that I used to just find extremely hard.
Like what?
Like going from a scrum into being able to get around the corner. So like the way the majority of teams would work is their second rows have to scrum. And scrums last a lot longer now than they used to. They're probably about 20 seconds now on average. They were maybe about 10 seconds back then. But you get through the scrum, you're pumping as hard as you can with your legs. Fla knows a lot more about this than I do, but like your legs would genuinely be heavy and on fire by the time the scrum's over. Then the next action has to be that you've got to bust your gut to get around the corner, so get around the other side of the ruck. And I used to just find that incredibly hard, because from a back rower standpoint, you're still working hard in the scrum, but it's nowhere near the same. And it's just completely different. So like the focus then for a back rower is just running smart angles and making sure you're at the rucks at the right time and like being in support. But with the second row, you got to just keep trucking, and that's what they want. They want to see the engine room, but you just keep going at a good solid pace for the whole game. And I used to find the transition incredibly hard. Like you'd think, oh, a back rower going to the second row will find it easy. It's not the case at all.
So when you look at someone like the way that England use their two lads, Maro Itoje and help me out, who am I missing here? My brain's gone dead. Thank you. Courtney Laws. So switching during a game, is that even harder? Because you've got yourself up to either I'm doing the sprints, and now I have to go into almost a single gear.
Yeah.
Thing.
I've done it during a game a couple of times.
Yeah.
I remember doing it during a game against Munster, actually, in Aviva, probably about 3 or 4 years ago. And I went into tight headlock because there was a yellow card or something happened. Mm. And our scrum got absolutely milled the minute I went to tight headlock. I hadn't done any practice there. And tight headlock is, like, I don't know, maybe fourth most important person in the scrum. And it's a different mindset, like, it really is. In back row, you're like, I want to give everything I can to the scrum, but actually the most important thing is that I form part of the defensive line as the ball gets passed out here.
Yeah.
Whereas in second row, you're just giving everything you can to the scrum. After the scrum's finished, now you're thinking about, okay, what's next? I've got to get going, got to get motoring. It's a different mindset. It's very hard to make the switch.
Yeah,
it's guys like Mario Toje, like, he's just an incredible athlete.
Yeah.
And he seems to be able to play the same way regardless of where he is, and that's the way England like to use him. But even like Scott Fardy now, he's got a consistent run at second row for Leinster. He's doing a great job there. I think having consistency in the same position, I think having a level of versatility can be a real curse. Like,
okay. So the current context is we've got Jordy Murphy moving to Ulster as a man who can play across the back row, really useful to have. Jerry, from a coaching point of view, when you see players who can play in multiple positions, be it forwards or somewhere else around the park, is that a challenge for you guys, or is that something that you can place real value on?
I suppose it depends on the stage of the player's career where he's at. In terms of versatility, is obviously going to make a coach's job easier because it just gives you more options during a game and gives you more options around selection, around what makes you go on your bench. But I suppose from a player's point of view, I think if you're constantly chopping and changing, say, in your formative years, say between 18 and 24, you're never really specialising in one position. And then someone else who's going to play, say, for instance, someone who specialises as a six is going to be a better six than you if you're playing six, lock, eight, a little bit of seven. And I think that's, from a player's point of view, whilst it might get you into the squad, it could ultimately hinder you as well long term. So you've got to learn to specialise and I suppose just spend some time in one of the positions so you learn the intricacies there and all the subtle lines that you got to run. And like Kev was talking there about, you know, if you're going to play six and then someone throws you in tight head lock, you know, it's very, very different. The conditioning challenges for that are, you know, they're night and day. And you know, you gotta be able to have the mind shift that you can adapt to that and understand that your game is going to have to change around the field a little bit if you go from six into tight head lock, because you're going to be there trying to maintain the spine of the scrum and scrummage on your hooker with your left shoulder, scrummage on your tight head with your right shoulder and hold shape all the way through. And if you lose your shape, that scrum is gone. Then you get up out of there and like that, you've got to get on the fold and get around the corner into the defensive line. It is a lot more difficult. But I think the key thing is players, when they have versatility, it gives them a better opportunity to be in a squad and get selected. But they just got to make sure that they're specialised somewhere first.
So, and that's an interesting point, because we're talking about Laws and Otoje. They've been actually doing something different again, which is switching during the match.
Yeah.
You know, which is a really interesting tactical thing for a coach to do, especially at the highest level. But Kev, I mean, it's fair to say, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you probably had more appearances and more caps by virtue of you being able to play two positions. Alan Quinlan used to be able to cover the same. Is that fair?
I think later in my career it helped.
Yeah.
Particularly when there were so many back rowers coming through, is that I could cover second row. Got me maybe into a couple of squads. But I specialised as a six for pretty much my whole career. When I was younger, I played some different positions, which helped me learn some new skills. Played a bit of number eight with UCD.
Yeah.
When I was playing under 20s and for the senior team there.
And why didn't that stick?
I think because I came into Leinster and Jamie was number eight. And then there was a chance at number six. And then it's a little bit like that. And I think the way I played probably suited. I maybe wasn't dynamic enough to be number eight in terms of my carrying. Like, so that was fine. But like, just interesting what Flav was saying there. Even like switching between six and seven, some people would say, oh, it's just flanker. It's not. Like, so it's so specialist. The lines you run, your exact role in the game is completely different as a six versus a seven. And someone like Reece Ruddock at the moment is doing an amazing job wherever he plays, but he's covering three positions essentially. It's a challenge for him. Like, where should he be focused? Because he goes into a game as a seven, his responsibilities are completely different than if he goes into a game as a six.
Okay, spell it out real simple, because I'm an idiot and I don't know what you mean by that. So what's the fundamental differences in how Reece Ruddock, or let's say a Geordie Murphy arriving in Ulster, would prepare for his job on the field, a six versus seven?
So, like, in a Joe Schmidt team, or I'm assuming it's the same with pretty much every team, the seven's role for every single play. So you might have, I don't know, eight scrum plays and six line-out plays going into the game. The seven's role will be completely different for every single one of those four or six. So the first three phases will be different. Also, as a seven, you're expected to be sort of the first player to ruck from set pieces. With a six on defensive plays, you're expected to hold width. So off a scrum, you stay wide, whereas the seven is supposed to kind of follow play more. There's low. I like Jerry was saying, it's subtle, like, lines that you're running. It's as a six, you're expected to maybe carry in tight areas more. A lot of it's subtle differences, but the role is different, and it's becoming more and more specialised. Actually,
you would have actually seen that, with like someone like Peter O'Mahony in the last game they played against Argentina. It's just he's just covering an awful lot of work, isn't he? And he's defending in the wide channels and the first guy to the defensive rucks as well. And it's just, it's specific. Whereas, you know, your open side then is having to do an awful lot more work, aren't they? Like, and kind of just show up more for carries as well and make the bigger carries too.
Jerry, from your perspective then, having someone like Quinlan or whoever might be able to cover those positions, I suppose, actually, I'm trying to make a really bad segue and I'm going to actually just stop. So Alan Quinlan...
Andy, before you jump in, just something that I was thinking as Kev was talking when you asked about him playing eight earlier in his career. I know I said it's important that you've got to specialise, and then the versatility is ultimately going to be an asset to you. But I think that I'm looking at some of the players that have come through Munster now and that are currently here, and I'm seeing how they've developed over their careers. And I'm looking at the New Zealand model. I'm looking at guys like Herbrand Grobbelaar, the second row we have in here, and Reece Marshall, who obviously come in not through an Irish system, but they're here now and they're adding value at Munster. And Herbrand used to play. He's a lock that we signed from Racing last year, and he's been injured now since he's come at the start of the year, but he played a few games for us at the start in pre-season, and you know, he's a fantastic player, like really, really good footballer. But when I spoke to Herbrand, he said, listen, he would have played 10 at the start, you know, when he was a kid. He would have played out half and played across the back line, so he would have had that skill set. And then as he physically, because rugby's a late specialisation game, you know, as you physically mature, you're physically growing into, well, where's the best position for me going to be? And Herbrand turned into a 6'6", 120 kilo lock, who now has the hands of an out half. And then, like, we would have had someone like Reece Marshall, who's our hooker, and Reece would have played in the back line and would have played flanker as well. Like, I spoke to Reece, he said, listen, when he was growing up in New Zealand, a lot of it was like whoever was closest to a lineout would throw the ball in, whoever was in the out half position would play out half, whoever was closest to the scrum would go in and play, would scrum. Because I think, just for when I look at my own from my own career, is that when I grew up, I started off, I was a prop, then I went in hooking, then I played a bit of back row, then I went back in hooking, and I was lucky that, you know, I'm not a particularly big guy, so I was able to I just did a lot of weights to try and get myself to a level where I could play at Test rugby. But I may have been better off if I, you know, maybe I might have had a longer career if I'd played in, for my frame, if I'd played in, as a nine or something like that. But because I was always stuck in the forward, I never developed that skill set. Whereas I could have played across many positions and then specialised then, as you'd seen, well, where does this guy's physical makeup fit the best? And he should have a pretty good skill set. And then around 17, 18, you start to understand, then you start to physically mature into, you know, into a man, and then you can see what position might fit your skill set, as long as you've got a rounded skill set, fit that best. Then you specialise then between, as a hooker, between 18 to maybe 24, and that's your position. Or as a back row, you might specialise as a 7, but then you have the ability then to be versatile and play a bit of 6 as well. But I think that I think that's a major asset to young players coming through when they've played a lot of positions, and then they pick a position then when they're 17, 18, you know, they have a much more rounded skill set.
That's hard to do if you're trying to get into a senior cup team when there's only a couple of matches a year. You know, I mean, maybe your system isn't perfect when it comes to giving players that time at a young age, Kev.
Yeah, potentially, but...
Yeah.
No, I think Jerry's exactly right there. It's... I think playing across different positions when you're younger helps build up your skill set, and then you need to specialise, but just not specialise too early. And I think there's lots of great examples of that. Jerry's just given a couple there, and I played a bit of centre at under 12s.
Yes.
Unfortunately, my hands weren't necessarily reflecting that when I played at senior level. But yeah, no, it is. It's something that's pretty important.
Right, quick change of pace. We are going into the back-to-backs in the Champions Cup. This is always a good time of year. There's something a little bit different about it, definitely from the outside. So, gents, is there something different about it as a player when you're preparing to face the same opponent over consecutive weeks?
Yeah, I think there is. I think what's really interesting for this is that it's December and it's already sort of a defining moment of the season.
Yeah.
It's incredibly hard, actually, and part of the issue at this time of the year is, okay, so say for Leinster playing the best team in England twice, two weekends in a row.
They're 8 points clear at the top, like they're flying.
They beat Sarries away, I think a couple of weeks ago. Yep. They just look really confident, and the thing about this time of year coming into these games is it's coming up to Christmas. There's so many distractions, there's so much going on. It's a real challenge to stay incredibly focused, and I think what we used to talk about in Leinster is kind of closing the ranks and, like, doesn't matter. Anything that's going externally, let's forget about it. Forget about everything else. This is the only important thing.
And is that different, though, then? Is it different having the same opponent 2 weeks in a row, though, as opposed to just a big game? Because what you're describing could also be the case for just a big game at a busy time of the year.
Yeah, it is. I think it's different. I think the fact is, particularly when you've got two teams, so the two best teams in the group, essentially, in that the two teams that are top, Exeter and Leinster, basically deciding who's going to finish top of the group now. I mean, if Exeter win both the games, Leinster are in serious trouble, you know what I mean? So there's that added kind of incentive, and then, like, Leinster going over there knowing they need minimum point, Exeter trying to make sure that they don't give them the point, and then going have to go back to the Aviva the following week. So that is definitely an added punch to the games because of that. It's a bit of a weird vibe, to be honest. You're shaking hands with the guys after the game going, I'm going to see you again next week, you bastard.
Like it's only half time, you know?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. But I think it's cool. It's a great part of the competition. It's probably the best 2 weeks in terms of the group stages.
Yeah. Fla, from your perspective, did you like these as a player?
Yeah, I did. I think initially when I first played in back-to-back fixtures, I struggled a little bit with, you know, I remember we played Dragons in the European Cup. This is a long time ago. This is over 10 years ago. We played Dragons in the European Cup back-to-back. And after the first game, we won, and we won pretty comfortably. And then I was really nervous then that, oh, I'm not taking this game seriously enough, and I was going to see the sports so I can sit in with him. And he said, listen, if you made the effort to come in and sit here with me and talk to me about the game, that you're worried that you're not taking it seriously enough for... you know, you can very easily, you know, games are won on such fine margins at times. Like, there's a scoreline might flatter you, but it might be one defining moment that might swing the game for you. But you could sit back and go, we won that game by 15, 16 points. So that was comfortable enough, but it could so easily have gone another way that you've got to really go and get a mind shift where you start at, you know, you go back to zero again when you're starting the prepping for the following week. Coming into this Leicester game now, I suppose, with a coach's hat on, the one thing is that we've been, you know, we had a break, say, after we played Dragons, and then we came in then and we had quite a long prep going into Zebra and then into Ospreys, and then it just felt like we had to do a huge amount of analysis, get an awful lot of work done and get messages across because you're integrating the Irish lads back into the team for the Leicester game. And now the fact that I would normally be preparing for the following week's game now at this stage, the fact that we're playing Leicester again, you know, it's kind of more like your review of this week's game becomes a preview. So it eases the workload a little bit as a coach, but you've probably got to be a lot more you've got to go through it with a, you know, you've got to try and find those any little things that you can find, because you're actually playing in the following week. So any plays that you show, that you know that they'll be prepared for them, and you've got to think of, it's a little bit of a cat and mouse game, isn't it? Like, well, how can we stay one step ahead here? If we did, we have an advantage in this area. Will we have the same advantage? How easy will it be for them to adjust? How much training time will they have to dedicate towards nullifying a threat that worked, you know, that they exposed them at the weekend? It's a lot of talk goes into it in the games, but or in the week after the game. But at the moment, we're just hoping to go out and just get a good performance against Leicester at home.
Yeah, like I just, something you said there, one of the challenges is, particularly after you win the first game, is not having any level of complacency, because generally after you win a game, you're playing someone different the next week. So obviously there's no complacency because it's a new team, a new challenge. But
do you mean that there's a natural reset, just start the process again?
Yeah, and that's hard because you're playing the same team, and like Flav said, you're doing pretty much the same analysis, and you're probably going to target them in the same areas. Whereas normally you win a game, that's done. It's a new team you're moving on to. This time you're the same guys, same players. And like, I remember we beat Northampton, by 40 odd points away from home, and I remember in the camp that week, I'm not saying we were complacent, but it was very hard to get revved up properly again. And there was this underlying kind of, oh, we beat them by 40 away from home, you know. And no matter how hard you try and how much talk, like that's a massive challenge for a team, and for that kind of maturity and the leadership within your squad to be able to go again and completely reset, as in mentally reset as well. Yeah. Because we lost to Northampton that weekend then. At home in the Aviva.
And I tell you what, at home in the Aviva isn't what it sounds like, because I remember that day, and even the crowd was complacent. The crowd was, it was a Christmas crowd, that's one thing, but it was, like, the game was going badly. You could feel that this
didn't
was not going
good.
Well.
It didn't feel good playing it either.
And I remember looking around and you going, guys, you actually don't realise what's going on. You're still thinking about last week, and this is a complete year from...
And that's where the closed rank things come in. It's like, forget about what everyone else is saying. Forget about the Christmas points going on. Like, the only thing that matters is that we completely wipe the slate clean and go again.
So actually the team that loses the first game has a major advantage because they have to reset.
Yeah, but like, as soon as you see that as an advantage for your team, I think that's kind of loser talk to a certain extent. You should be like, I think the team that wins should be like, it doesn't matter, that's done, we need to go again. And that's the mentality you have to have, and that's what the best teams do. That's what the All Blacks do, for instance. So go again,
it'd be a matter of like, just if you're on top, try and make sure the team doesn't even get a point, you know, like just kind of drive it home.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Just being ruthless. And
all right. Well, we'll see how this weekend goes.
Case in point. Sorry, Andy. Case in point on that one is our fixtures against Leicester last year. I think we put 38 points on them in Tomlin Park, and then the following week we went over to Welford Road and we lost. Mm. And, you know, that's a really good example of what Kev is talking about there. So I suppose you can only take it, it's a cliche, but you only take it a game at a time. But we're, after this one, then we got to reset and go back to zero, which we didn't do last year, I suppose, and Leicester caught us. So
I'll see, we'll leave it in the coach's capable hands, if you reckon. Listen, we'll be back later on to answer your Twitter questions, but up next we talk player migration and rugby with Alan Dimmock from Rugby World magazine.
The Hard Yards, passionate about sport.
You know, you got to be greedy when you're playing, because it'll all be gone and then you'll be sitting in a studio with three dickheads.
Jerry literally ran downstairs, climbed over a wall and harassed the guy who was cleaning the pathways and told him to
stop. He wasn't cleaning the pathways, he was blowing leaves from one fucking car to the other. I said, what are you doing? The Yoda of rugby. Drop this Ellen DeGeneres shit. McFadden had his go on Twitter, it's dead now.
Welcome back to the Hard Yards. Player migration is a hot topic in rugby. Project players, the extension of the residency rule from 3 to 5 years, the apparent requirement that every professional club in France must carry at least one Georgian front row and a Fijian wing. While we often dwell on the more famous cases, usually at test level, there is a wider story to tell. It's much wider. I'm very pleased to be joined by Alan Dimmock, whose investigation into player migration in rugby is a special report in the current issue of Rugby World magazine. Alan, welcome to the Hard Yards.
Hiya, thanks for having me.
Listen, this feature is a cracker. South Africans playing in Romania, Islanders in Japan. I think promise and pitfalls is probably a good summary. It's well worthwhile people seeking this out. What did you think you were going to find when you started this?
Well, the working title I actually had in my head was Human Traffic, because I was interested in the idea of finding the players that we don't know about that find themselves in terrible positions, in places they never thought they'd end up. You hear a lot of urban myths about players that sort of disappear in the wilderness, and I think a lot of people that have played a good level of club rugby to the UK and Ireland, you know, they played with guys from the Pacific Islands, they played with guys from South Africa, from all over, and some of these guys flit in and out of clubs. You see them moving down the chains, and you sometimes find yourself wondering what happened to these guys. Of course, the idea of human traffic, I find, was quite extreme and in many respects a little bit far-fetched. But what I did end up finding was story after story of people that had found themselves in those difficulties that I imagined and try to play their way out of it, even just to make a crust. And I was very lucky to get in tour with some very good people, especially the Pacific Rugby Players Welfare Group that's run by Dan Leo. You'll have seen a lot from Dan over the last couple of months talking about the plight of the Samoans. And the guys from the official body that work with the International Rugby Players Association, Pacific Rugby Players, and it's important to remember the distinction between the two, because one is an official arm that works. And starting off with these guys, they just introduced me to a number of stories, and it just sort of snowballed from there, really.
Yeah, and I think we want to be straight in here that some of this involves players actually dying in various circumstances. There's an extraordinary quote from Aoife Tokafa, who's a hooker at Dijon, and he says, "I've sent too many brothers back in coffins." Well, what was he getting at there?
So, and this is a big thing when you speak to the foundations that look at Pacific player welfare. Depression is a big issue that's sort of been underreported for a few years. It's something that they're seen as sort of the hidden menace on the Pacific Islands, but as well as that, when you marry it with the number of pressures that particularly some of these guys that come across to Europe to play rugby face, some of them go further down the levels in Europe, and particularly France is what we're talking about in this instance here, is sometimes the amount of money you get isn't fantastic, but there's a social pressure that these guys have. It's a cultural issue that they have going back to the islands, is the idea of supporting your family. So a lot of these guys will come over to Europe in order to make money, to send money home. It's just, it's possibly the biggest industry, or one of the biggest industries on the island, is people, as the diaspora sending money back. Of course, with these guys, some of them not being paid very much, you don't have much to live off of. If you're not playing well and drop, sometimes money isn't guaranteed. And if there's pressure to play from your family back home, and you're not living on very much, and there's a shame attached to that, and you throw in the horrible spectre of depression, it's a terrible circumstance for some of these guys to be in. And I suppose the most high-profile case is a guy called Israeli Temo, who we heard about a few seasons ago, who took his own life. And I spoke very briefly to a guy called Sunia Koto, who's a tight-head prop for Fiji, who had to explain to the family back in the islands that Israeli Temo had chosen to take his own life. Can you imagine making that phone call? How brutal that must be. Explain to someone that part of the world is just coming away and it's on the other side of the planet and you don't know anything about it. Those are the instances that we're talking about here. These guys have sent back, there's been a few cases now in Europe. And if you speak to the guys in the welfare groups, they're talking to folk all the time that are dealing with these problems and having to offer them help. And I suppose that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this, is to open people's eyes to the fact that this is going on, but also to hopefully help get the message out there that there is help there for these fellas. You know, they don't have to struggle through it alone, and that's why these guys, the Pacific Rugby Players Welfare Group and the Pacific Rugby Players Group, are there to help. I suppose it's just getting the message out there. One of the bigger issues, and I suppose it's how I tail-ended the piece, is that we need to be talking more about it as well. The public at large needs to be aware of this, and people within rugby need to seriously start talking about it. It's all very good talking about the upper end of the leagues. You know, there'll be elite leagues. But if you're a fantastic international class player playing in these top leagues, chances are you'll be well looked after. It's when we start going down the levels, that's when we need to start looking at things.
Yeah, I thought it was notable. It's really at the start, and it appears as a theme a number of times through the feature, that we probably do. It's easy headlines and easy airtime and easy column inches to talk about, you know, such and such as a project player. Is he a real Irish international? Is he a real Scottish international or whatever? But you know what? If he's in that position, he's probably doing all right. But you are, you've chosen to look at some of these people who just, they need a job.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting that because in part of it, I look at the player drain out of South Africa. And what's going on in South Africa is, you know, it gets a lot of airtime. You know, you see it as a crisis. Of course, in the piece I speak to an agent who says that the crisis could worsen if people don't eradicate the role of dodgy agents, of sort of pirate agents, if you'd like. That actually the agents in South Africa have had enough, and they might take players out, even more players, quality players, out of South Africa because they can make more money elsewhere around the world. And that's what it all boils down to, really, is that some of these guys just want to make a better living. Of course, you look at the other side of that. I spoke to a current Romanian international, Johan van Heerden, who is from South Africa. And he made an interesting point that people get on the high horse talking about residency rules, but for some people, can you imagine, like, for a 5-year residency rule now, there's a lot of people that are actually going to miss out on a lot of money. This folk might not want to sign them now. And a very simple point that was made to me is just that this could not have a knock-on effect to people's earning potential. And we get so caught up with international rugby, but really, for a lot of these guys, Test rugby is just something on the horizon that could maybe make them more money in the future. They're just trying to play and make some cash. And that is what we keep, you're right, that is something that we keep coming back to in the future.
The South African example is interesting because there's a fully fledged Tier 1 nation and they too are complaining about player drain. The Grey College Montpellier link up is something you pointed out there. So Grey College supplied a phenomenal number of Springboks through the years, and they have an agreement or a tie up with a French club with lots and lots of money.
Yeah, and I mean, Montpellier aren't tipped on the hand world at the moment either. You'll see a gift during the rounds in November of the phenomenal try that was scored by one of the Georgian players. But the thing that kept hitting me was every time he dived in to score this impossible try in the corner, up flashed an advertising hoarding for Altrad, the Altrad group. Boyd Altrad obviously owns Montpellier. As recently as the summer, tried to buy shares in Gloucester Rugby in this country. And, you know, it's a thinly veiled attempt to get the hooks in with Grey College with this, the scholarship that's going in there. It's called the Badawi Legacy Scholarship Programme. And, you know, that is officially an academic programme, but there will be some rugby tie-ins eventually. Some people find that slightly insidious. Certainly, folk I've spoken to in South Africa see that as the coils starting to wrap around South African rugby. And it's, you know, we should say that that's only the beginning, but the reality is that I've spoken to people in South Africa that believe that the famous Craven Week, for example, and Yuri Roo, the CEO of SARU, said this to me. I had an academy that said to me that scouts are actually walking up to watch teenage boys play rugby in South Africa, you know, to scout them to see what their potential is. And it's been suggested that some are being tapped up even before they're 18 years old, which actually no one is allowed to do. You're not allowed to, you know, SARU aren't technically supposed to approach these guys about contracts until after they're 18. So when you've got that going on in the background, and then you've got an official scholarship opening up, and then you have agents complaining that there are pirate agents out there that are operating, you know, it's got to be a worry for South African rugby in the future. Not just because of where their test stars will end up. Again, we end up talking about the guys at the very top end. But actually, you've got to start worrying about where the next generation is going to end up. You know, and it's obviously, this is a very nuanced issue for South Africa because the visa issues that you get with South Africa is interesting. The young people want to have the opportunity to be able to study abroad, to broaden their horizons. Some people would just love to jump at that chance. But when you pour in the rugby side of things as well, you've got to wonder how many of these young talented players that could go on to be Springboks if given the chance to play in their own country and looked after well in their own country as well, you've got to wonder where that generation will end up in 3 or 4 years' time.
You also approached World Rugby for a view on the academies that some teams have set up in the islands. What did you get back there? Because that's certainly, speaking personally, that's something which does not sit comfortably with me.
Well, I mean, you've got to appreciate World Rugby's view on this. They say that they're working closely with Pacific Rugby Players, the official union. They're looking at agent accreditation in the island. It's an easy one to dance around, because all you need is the permission of a local union. When it comes to the way that agents operate in a union, for example, that is all down to the union. That's not really something that World Rugby have to look out for as a whole. What many people are saying, though, is that it needs to be policed more seriously, and that any deals that are done need to be looked at quite closely, because we've seen in the very recent past that whether bankrupt or not, there are specific island unions that are struggling. And if you're in a financial position where you're not going well, and someone says, oh, by the way, we want to set up this thing and we'll pay for it ourselves on your island, I'm imagining it must be quite hard to say no to. It's certainly something that the player welfare groups, certainly Pacific Rugby Players Welfare, the other official branch, who are doing some really good work at the moment, at least bringing people together. That is a serious concern of theirs, looking at the fact that Claremont, for example, have an academy on the island. Now, on the one hand, I've spoken to some people that say if it's handled properly, if it's aligned with the union, it's great, because of the best will in the world, these guys cannot, at the moment, be professional players on their own island. Fiji Sevens, for example, one of the best rugby teams of any code on the planet, keep going in and out. It's like the Hokey Cokey with contracts for these guys. So if there's a way where you can humanely treat people with respect and with the right intentions in mind, train someone to be able to go and play professional rugby somewhere else around the world and make good money, that's got to be supported. What people are wondering is, what are the true intentions of these? Because they look like it's just a way of bringing in talent to France in particular, and aligning the big teams like Claremont with the next big thing from the island. I suppose it also comes back to the idea of, and it's something else attached to that, is that it's something that a few agents, reputable agents, Adam Porter from, is one of the directors at CSM, for example, and he's got a lot of experience with the island. In fact, CSM helps support academies on the islands as well, but that are run by fellows from those islands. The idea that there needs to be a register, there needs to be a promoted register of agents operating, particularly in the Pacific Islands, and held up so that when a young guy that doesn't know what he's doing when he wants to travel around the world knows, okay, at least this is someone I should be speaking to, because they will look after me properly. And that's the big thing. And that's, again, that's one of the things that the unions can crack down on if they're aware of it. Hmm. People need to know who they're working with.
And World Rugby, in fairness, said, look, they're interested in and are implementing structures to provide a pathway for locally based players. Yeah. They point out the funding of the Fijian Drua and the Australian
of
NRC.
Course, yeah.
And they make the point that they'll assist a union who actually says there is something going on in our nation which is detrimental to our pathway to Test Rugby. Pat, you wanted to come in there.
Oh yeah, I was just saying, Alan, that you were talking about the pressures of playing there, and I suppose just the thing, again, we're looking at the top end a lot of the time, but guys playing through injuries and maybe feeling that pressure to play through serious injuries, did you come across that a good bit?
It's something in previous features I've spoken to a lot about as well, and it's a global issue. I did a piece on concussion, an investigation on concussion a few years back, and I was speaking to guys in professional rugby in Russia, and there were a large number of these Russian teams who were on pay-to-play basis, and it added a brutal aspect to things. As you go further down the levels, you're right, there is that sort of pay-to-play element to it, and that it's obviously a hard one to look after, and particularly when you look at it through the prism of the Pacific Islands as well. When people don't even know the exact number of players that are playing in Europe, when people haven't kept track of who's left the islands, where they've rocked up, where they've gone afterwards, and people start funneling down the levels, as I mentioned earlier, they keep can't keep track of these guys. You don't know who's playing for who. You don't know who's playing on a pay-to-pay contract or a part-time basis where they're having to work in a nightclub as security at the evenings and then go through training and then play at the weekend. And if that's the only way that they can send money home and they've got to strap themselves up and get on with it, you're right, that is a worrying element of pressure. And that is a largely semi-professional issue, and that's where the concern comes in that who's really policing further down these divisions. And there are semi-professional teams. We had one of the pull quotes we used in our piece was, the struggle is real in the federal divisions, boys really find it difficult, in some instances it's inhumane. And I think that's what you're hinting at, is it, Pat?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. As you said, inhumane is almost a great way to sum it all up, isn't it?
Hmm. And there's always going to be a philosophical thing about people are attached to the purity of test rugby, but there's also the human right to be able to make a living, and those two things have to be balanced in some way. Alan, thanks very much for your time.
There is one last point I want to make, and it is one thing as well. But a lot of this sounds doom and gloom, but I did speak to a lot of people who have made their lives better through playing rugby. Mm-hmm. And the whole point of this investigation is not just to say this is a nightmare scenario where everything is terrible. There are some people, and particularly in the cases, instances of people I spoke to in Eastern Europe, folk have made their lives better through playing rugby abroad. And I suppose that's an important thing to bear in mind when we then go on to say that it all needs to be looked at a little bit closer, though, because outside of the test arena, there's a lot of people that need that.
That's very fair. Okay. So that's Alan Dimmock from Rugby World magazine. I would urge you to seek out the January 2018 issue. It's well worth your time looking at that feature. You won't see many mention of stars in this. It's about fairly average club players looking for a better life in a lot of cases. So Alan, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Yeah. Up next, we'll be taking a look at the weekend's games and see if Pat can try and close the gap in our competition.
The Hard Yards, passionate about sport.
You're listening to the Hard Yards Rugby Podcast on Sports Joe. If you're a fan of the show, please leave us a ratings on iTunes. It helps other people find the podcast. We're going to preview some of the weekend's games now. Just in case some of you listening haven't heard, Pat and myself have been having a predictions competition since the start of the season. And Pat, it's fair to say it's been a rocky road.
There's been some highs and lows. I was hoping that we could get, it looked good last week. I think I was 4 from 5, and then I just couldn't.
Good
close,
week last week.
Couldn't close it out though. Yeah.
Yeah. So 4-3 to you last week.
Scraped another point back.
Keep that scoreboard ticking over. Yeah. Right. Listen, we'll tear straight in. Munster versus Leicester. Munster are 7-point favourites at home. I will go first for all of these. Munster. I'm taking Munster on this. Feeling in my bones. That's all.
Yeah, 7 points. I'll go with that as well.
Okay. So both for Munster this week. Harlequins are 4-point favourites at home versus Ulster. This is a funny one. I don't have a solid feeling on this game at all. I'm going to go with Harlequins, but I'm not sure I like it.
I don't know. I think this could be. I'll go Ulster. Just to spice up my weekend.
And lastly, Exeter versus Leinster. Exeter 2-point favourites at home. I'm going Exeter on this. They're flying, and Leinster are playing some good stuff as well, but I'm going Exeter.
Yeah, I thought you might go Exeter, because I'm going Exeter as well, so that's why I spice things up there with the Ulster one. I can see there's talk about Leinster want to get out of there, but get close, but I think Exeter are going to do it. They're in great form since the start of the season.
They really are, yeah. So look, of the three games, where do you reckon, like, obviously points aside, where do you reckon the big things to look out for are here this weekend?
It'll just be like Munster. I just have a load of injuries, like, so just kind of if they can I suppose get any type of win possible. As you said, just win your home games. I don't think they'll be looking for bonus point wins or anything like that.
They're both tied at the top of the group, 6 points, and then Racing are behind in 5, and Castor aren't out of it. They got 3, so like that's a tight pull.
Yeah, yeah. And then the Ulster one, they're conceding and scoring a hoop load of tries as well, so that might just be an interesting one to watch, because Harlequins aren't locked, you know, they're not watertight either, so that should be, could be an interesting game. Hopefully it's a high scoring game.
Yeah, I mean, a win for Ulster there really transforms how that pool looks, because their third, you know, obviously La Rochelle are flying, but that would transform their season.
Yeah, and they, I know they're not going to play it from for next season, but the fact that they have Moore and Murphy, it looks like they're at least building towards something, so hopefully that's picked them up a little bit, and yeah, they kind of, they get the job done, and still have the likes of Stockdale and Henderson and stuff to call on as well. So
yeah, and I suppose before we won't go away without mentioning Connacht. There is no line that I could find for this, so we won't be doing a prediction on it, but they're a way to breathe. I just want to note Kieran Keane's comments after the loss to Zebre. I'm disappointed, it's a bit of a head scratcher, that one. Everything broke down on us. He's done this a couple of times this year.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, that's not something we see that often.
Yeah, it's funny, because yeah, he was talking about the dressing room being quiet and stuff like that, yeah, and no one's stepping up, and he's worried about that as well. It's such a strange, because I was saying Connacht knew what they were hiring when they got him in, you know, because they would have interviewed the lad, like, and but completely different from Pat Lamb. Like, Pat Lamb's a motivator, or this guy seems to be, you know, the hard taskmaster. So, great copy, you know, like, it probably sounds great as well, but some of the players can't be too happy hearing this kind of stuff every second week.
Okay, so heading into the weekend, Saris are still, even after losing, I think they've lost five in a row now. Now that includes the Anglo-Welsh, which is a, well, it's kind of rugby.
Yeah.
15-8 favourites for the title. Leinster 4-1, Toulon 7-1, and Exeter 9-1. Of context, Munster 14-1, and I think Ulster are out 33-1 or around then.
That seems fair.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll see how the weekend unfolds. Up next, we have listener questions with Kevin Fla.
Murder, She Wrote is the perfect thing to watch during the day. You can watch the start, fall off for 40 minutes, come back, see the end, perfect. You know what I mean? You've missed nothing really. Remember Raj Kev in the Killiney, he used to have to bring two TVs into the room, one for you for Cheltenham. Like every red-blooded male in the country, he'd be watching the horse racing, whereas I'd have a TV for myself for things like Murder, She Wrote and Houses Under the Hammer. Murder, She Wrote is the perfect thing to watch during the day.
Kev and Flair are back to answer your fan questions. We put a call out yesterday and these are the best ones we got in. Use the hashtag AskTHY on Twitter if you want to ask a question to next week's panel. First one, this is directed your way, Jerry, from Mark McMahon. Jerry Flannery had some of the best darts in the game. Who does Jerry see as Ireland's next up-and-coming long-time hooker after Rory Best hangs up his boots?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think probably prior to this November series, you would have thought that, you know, I suppose the guys who were in the mix were probably Rob Herring up in Ulster, Sean Cronin, I think is still there and thereabouts, James Tracy and Niall Scannell. I'm not sure if I'm missing him there, but at the moment I'd say that they're the guys who'd be in the mix. Niall Scannell obviously missed the November internationals. Looking at them, I think Niall Scannell is a very, very strong scrimmager. I think they're a fan of his in national camp, and he's done well. Rob Herring, really, really well-rounded player. And then I suppose James Tracy, you know, they're a fan of his scrummaging as well, and he's a converted prop. And I think that Joe Schmidt probably has time, has a lot of time for him, because he would have been involved in him, as I understand it, you know, making the move from prop to hooker. Sean Cronin then is always going to be there because of what he can do around the field. I think the thing for these guys is that Rob Herring is competing with Rory at the moment, just for game time at Ulster. Sean Cronin is competing with James Tracy and I suppose Rickard Strauss and one of the Byrne brothers as well. And then Niall Scannell is competing with the lads we have down below here when he's fit. So I think it's the guy who actually nails down the provincial jersey is the guy who's really going to push himself forward. I think it's really going to be whoever nails their provincial jersey is the guy who's going to start pushing in then and take over from Rory eventually.
Now, something that Mark also sent over was a YouTube video of you pulling a beanie over your eyes, looking at the camera, and then throwing a line-out ball into a dustbin from about 20 yards. Do you remember that, do you?
I do, yeah. It was after the 2011... Well, it wasn't after the 2011 World Cup, but after I got injured at the 2011 World Cup, I flew back and I was training with some of the cripples in Munster, all the lads who were long-term injured, and we were just trying to do trick shots and mess around with the balls and stuff like that. So
yeah, it's good. Good skills. Very impressed. Right, next question. Kev, this is from Carl O'Donoghue. What is the fewest amount of points that Munster and Leinster will see as acceptable from the back-to-backs?
I think what we as players used to always be told by the coaches was two wins was the only thing that was acceptable, but I think in the back of their heads it would be 5 points as a minimum. I think if Leinster get 5 points against Exeter, they're in the driving seat in the group. I think Munster are in a similar enough position as well, in that it's very close. I think they're level on points.
It's a much tighter group,
Leicester.
The dynamic is different in that group.
Yeah, I think probably Munster will be looking for, or probably need maybe slightly more than 5 points to get nudge ahead of Leicester. It's slightly tighter in that, whereas Leinster have a kind of 2 point advantage over Exeter at the moment. But like, you're thinking a minimum of a point away from home. You don't get a point away from home when you're under pressure, and then you just have to win your home game.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. There's no other answer. And you're thinking, right, like, we have a great chance of winning from away from home, but minimum a point.
Okay, so five points acceptable, even though you mightn't say that to the players at the time. 6 points, yeah, something's gone right here in one of the games. You know, and then more than that, you're
flying.
You're done. Okay, excellent. Right, I think that's it for this. Hold on, Pat.
I have my hand up. It's not a Twitter question, but Jerry, I was just wondering how you guys have been happy with Chris Clote since he started playing. He's looked great in his first couple of games.
Yeah. Chris is settled in really, really well. He's 100% a specialist open side, and we were really fortunate that as Chris came in, Tommy O'Donnell picked up an injury up in national camp with his AC, which would have left us a little bit thin there. And Chris came in and he's had a big impact. And he's a clever player in terms of, I think if you saw his try there at the weekend when he was tackled, he released the ball, got up, and then picked it up again and went in and scored. He's short, but he's very, very powerful. And he's slotted in well here. It's going to be, you know, I think he's a good addition to the squad, and you know he gives us something different at the moment, particularly since we lost Conor Oliver at the start of the year, who was a young open side that had played fantastically well for us last year, and we were looking forward, you know, he was tearing up in pre-season. We lost losing Conor, he injured his shoulder in pre-season, and that would have left us thin in terms of cover at seven. So Chris came in, and luckily, as Chris came in, or unlucky for Tommy, but lucky for us that Chris was able to step in then when Tommy was injured.
You have to find the jersey to fit the man as well.
I'd say whatever jersey we find, he's going to just try and get it tapered in to make him look bigger.
Yeah, save it.
Small man syndrome. I know a lot about it myself.
Right, so yeah, I mean, speaking of Munster, there's actually a huge number of injuries down there. Vlad, do you think that's something that people actually realise?
Look, injuries are part of the game, and you generally, you just have to accept them. It can be tough, but you know that's rugby, and people are going to get injured, and that's why you have a squad, and people got to step up, and that's the challenge of. That's why the season is such a marathon here, because you're gonna lose players, but the opportunities then that arise then for young players to step up, and you know when they perform, it's great. It's like getting, you know, shit, I have an extra player now. Next time I want to go and pick the team.
But that's sometimes it's like people are kind of. We were actually speaking to Andrew Trimble last week, and it's kind of like sometimes it's the commentary, like Trimble might say that he's in bad form at the moment like that, but it's also just sometimes it's just the opinion of a guy who's just commentating on a game. And that's, you've seen sometimes with George Hook, people take that as their opinion. But I saw recently there, like Alan Quinlan was kind of talking, given he was a little bit critical, I'd say, of that Zebre game, of how Munster got on and how they handled it. But then, you know, we saw that Zebre team went out and beat Connacht last week as well. Does that kind of stuff get back to you, Jerry?
Well, look, if you're playing a sport, as a player, criticism is going to come, and you just, like, you take it from the right people, in terms of your coaches are going to try and give you constructive criticism to try and make you a better player. And as a player, then you just, what you want from that is that you want to make sure that the coach has gone and he's put work in, that he's done the analysis and that he's thought about this and that he's put work into it before he passes on this stuff to you. And players with a growth mindset will take it on board, and that's how to become better players. For me as a coach, I know that there's going to be criticism leveled against the team. And that's it, because you rarely ever play a perfect game, so you've got to be able to take that. I suppose in terms of when people hear someone like Alan Quinlan coming out and criticising how we're going, I suppose if I look at it, like Alan Quinlan played some great games for Munster, and people will take on board that if Alan Quinlan is speaking in Munster, they'd say, well, most people watch a game to be entertained, and they expect the co-coms, the guy who's doing the commentary with them, to provide analysis. But I don't think that just having played for Munster gives you any kind of insight. You actually have to prepare for the games. And when I don't feel like that people have actually properly prepared for the game and they're doing it last minute, you have to look at it from the point of view that, like, we spent an awful lot of time preparing and working hard. We had a lot of young players who were playing in that match. We were missing two international loose heads, an international hooker, an international tight head, missing Herbrandt Grobbelaar and Dave O'Callaghan, missing Peter Manny, Lions captain, missing Tommy Donnell, international 7, CJ Stander, Lions number 8, Conor Murray, Lions 9, Ian Keatley, Irish 10, Tyler Blaendahl, Andy Conway, another Irish international, Yaku Tout, Springbok international, Chris Farrell, Irish international 13, Dan Goggin missing as well, another good young player. We're missing this amount of players, and you have to look at things in context. Like, when he looked at the game, I don't know whether he'd done any preparation for it. I don't think he had. It didn't seem like he had, because when people relayed the comments back to me, I just thought, this doesn't make sense. And I suppose the people who watch it and they say, well, Alan Quinlan must know what's going on in Munster because he played with them. But Alan Quinlan has absolutely no idea what goes on in Munster. Nothing. He hasn't got an iota of what we do in here. And I think that I understand that people will come out and they give their opinion, but their opinion should be based on something. If it's not based on preparation, well, then they're actually not doing their job, and they shouldn't be getting paid for that, in my opinion. Like, if I don't do my work as a coach, you know, I'm going to get sacked. And I can still get sacked even if I do my work, if results don't go my way, and if I can't get my message across to the players, or if I'm giving the wrong message. I'm happy with that. I just think that there should be a level of accountability as well for other people who are out there. Like, if for instance that Sky think it's deemed credible that if someone's just played for a club, that they can just go out and just give their opinion without actually doing any work. But they're kind of cheating the viewers, because people are paying for a subscription to watch it. They want to get some sort of analysis, or if they're not getting that, then, you know, there's a breakdown there.
Well, in fairness to
Quinny was very good on Ireland's Fittest Family, you know, he's good at that stuff. But
In fairness, I think you've got something off your chest there, Fla. In fairness to Quinny, he's not here. And I will say that I think we have to assume that he does do his own work, and maybe there's a difference in perspective. I think you're saying that there was lacking some context with all those players out. Maybe we'll put out to see if Quinny will do a special Hard Yards appearance. What do you reckon?
No, look, you're right. You're right. I'm not trying to... It was more that Alan said himself that he came in last minute for the Zebre game when it was put to him, because there was something happened with Ian Evans. Ian Evans couldn't do it, so he came in last minute. And I think Quinny should have should be able to empathise with the players and know when there's lads there who've worked that hard, that you at least have to do, you either temper your comments and you look at it in context and say, well, geez, this is a Zebre team that went and beat Ulster at home. They actually, they went and beat Connacht the week after after we scored four tries plus on them. So you just look at it in context, and it's, look, sometimes it can be irritating when guys that were part of the club are doing that, you know. But I don't know whether they see it as kind of like a kind of an attachment to their time with the club, and they don't want to see the club move forward because then they're not held in the same standing that they might have been if the club is moving forward. But that's a really it's a poor mindset to have, from my opinion.
I look forward to joining you two next week soon for a pint, and we'll see how well this goes.
That's a good idea. Yeah,
it is a good idea. The Hard Yards on tour. Right, we'll leave. We'll leave it there. Right. Thanks to Kev, to Jerry, to Pat and Alan Dimmock. Paul Donegan was on sound. We'll be back next Thursday with a new podcast. Subscribe to it on iTunes, Podcast Republic, SoundCloud and every good podcast app to get it straight to your phone. I'm Andy McGeady. This has been The Hard Yards. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you next week.
The Hard Yards. Passionate about sport.